Teal.
The 7th annual Melbourne Anarchist Book Fair is on Saturday, August the 12th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. The book fair showcases more than 40 stalls and a program of workshops. It's a great opportunity to be introduced to new ideas, to challenge your thinking and to meet with like-minded folk.
It's free and we also provide free childcare. At the Brunswick Town Hall on Saturday, August the 12th from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. Find out more at www.amelbournebookfair.org. Or find us on Facebook, the Melbourne Anarchist Book Fair. The Melbourne Anarchist Book Fair is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome. Hi, I'm Bill. Welcome to the Living Free Show. We're talking on 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. This week we're talking about recovering from alcoholism and how support from a 12-step group like Alcoholics Anonymous can make a real difference. I'd like to welcome Lisa and Lindsay to the 3CR studio this afternoon. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi, I'm Lindsay.
They're both members of Alcoholics Anonymous and will share their experience with alcoholism and how AA has helped them. Right. Lisa, so growing up, what was your growing up life like, and did you have any alcoholics in your family?
Yes, Bill. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and like a lot of kids in that situation, I swore I was never going to drink when I grew up. But unfortunately, what happens in Australian society is you go to high school and, you know, you get into alcohol. It's in our culture, and some of us can't handle it, and I was one of them.
Right. So how did that impact on your life at home when you started drinking?
I think I was hiding it. I remember drinking before I went to an exam. You know, normal kids don't do that. You know, I started drinking, I think, and hiding it to just cope with the stress, because home life wasn't great, and I couldn't let anyone know about it. I think denial in my family. I know two of my grandfathers were alcoholic too, so it's like I'm third generation, and denial runs really deep in my family.
Yeah. And I understand that you had difficulties with your parents early on.
My parents' alcoholism, you know, impacted on their marriage, of course, and my mother actually couldn't cope with family life, and actually left us kids when I was about 8 for a year. You know, Dad just went downhill from there, you know, drinking, and we started living with my grandparents at that time.
Right, and one of those is drinking as well.
That was on the other side of the family.
Oh, okay.
So that was one of my non-alcoholic grandfathers. So we did get some stability. My dad was, you know, living across the road and drinking more and more, and, you know, lost his license 2 or 3 times in the 70s, which, you know, didn't happen a lot.
So that's pretty hard,
and he wasn't really trying hard. you know, I started drinking probably when I was about 16, 17, really. You know, just going out with, you know, kids and parties, and, you know, I had no boundaries at home at all. You know, sneaking in late and going out and getting drunk. It actually got quite bad when I was 19, I remember. I dropped out of uni after a year. And I got severe depression as well, which I now know was exacerbated by the drinking. And when I was 21, after a series of very embarrassing and shameful 21st birthday parties, I went to my first AA meeting.
Oh, wow. That was early in those days.
It was.
So what was that like?
It was terrifying. I was, as I said, 21, and unfortunately at that meeting I think there was only one or two women there. The others were men, and they were really old and in their 50s.
Yeah.
I know
what that feels
yeah,
like.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Present company accepted, of course. Yeah, I'm getting close to that now. So, but I saw the banners on the wall, and I saw the God word, and it freaked me out. I thought, oh, my God, this is a religious cult. What are they going to do to me? I'm in such a wrong place. And I heard the stories, and you know, the men were talking about losing their houses and their kids and their families and their jobs. And, you know, I was in my first job, wasn't married, didn't have a home, didn't have any kids to lose, and so I could not identify at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it scared the hell out of me. And I think it probably, you know, stopped me drinking for a little bit. But at that point, you know, I thought, if I just decide not to drink that night, I'll be fine. And I had no idea that, you know, even just having one drink, once you're an alcoholic, you know, that sets off the whole allergy, the, you know, insatiable craving for more and more and more, which I did not find out about 4 years. So, you know, in vain, I would just try and go out for a couple of drinks, or, you know, I'll just have 2 or 3, you know, that never-ending refrain, or this, you know, tonight will be different, and it never did.
Mm, yeah. So over to you, Lindsay. So when did you realise alcohol was an issue for you?
Oh, look, I wasn't raised in an alcoholic home. And I was a, you know, like a good boy. I used to go to school. I did well at school. Went to university. Alcohol didn't really start to become a problem for me until I was in my probably late 20s, and I started to realise that things were happening that were out of my control, and that I was having trouble regulating the amount of alcohol that I took once I started, and trying to not drink became more and more of a problem.
Right. Yeah. So you're actually working in a difficult industry, I understand.
That's right.
Being an alcoholic.
That's right. Well, all the way through university, I supported myself by working in bars and nightclubs and bottle shops and that sort of thing. And the first job that I got after I graduated, because I majored in biochemistry, microbiology, mycology, that sort of thing, was in the wine industry. So I moved to Sydney and worked for a large wine company there. With the yeasts and ferments and that sort of thing, and eventually I wanted to get more into the nitty gritty of winemaking and move to the Barossa Valley.
Right.
And I worked for a number of different wine companies, but one in particular for quite a few years. And during my time there, the drinking culture in the Barossa Valley is quite active, as you can imagine,
yeah.
Both at work and outside of work.
Yeah.
And it's a very social environment. I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. But some things started happening that made me realise that I was developing quite a problem with alcohol.
Right.
Yeah. And it was in the form of, motor car accidents and fights and just being unreliable, making errors at work when you're winemaking can be very expensive.
Yes. I'm sure. So what did you do?
Well, there was a time when I made a decision that I needed to change. I needed to get back to the sort of medical microbiology and biochemistry that I had been trained for. And I needed to get back to home, back to Melbourne.
Yeah.
I'd spent probably 10 years in Queensland, in Sydney and in the Barossa Valley. I needed to come back and sort of make things up again with my parents, who I had left, just walked out on. And I also thought that I needed to get back to a more normal life that didn't involve drinking and a type of work that didn't involve alcohol. So.
Right, yep. So what did you do then? So you
I worked as a medical scientist at a large hospital in Melbourne, and was doing some quite important work that required quite a lot of skill and reasonably high paid, and I was able to buy a house. I found. Some people say that you take a hostage. I'm not sure whether it was quite like that, but I needed somebody who didn't drink.
Yeah.
Somebody who was, reliable and wanted to, have a family. And so my life became sort of, on the outside at least, very, very respectable and ordinary.
And professional, I suppose.
And professional, right. Yeah. But little did I know that... I had actually become an alcoholic by then. I certainly didn't want to admit it to myself or anybody else, but I was certainly showing the signs of alcoholism, and they manifested themselves in when the going started to get tough, like financially or at work or at home, when things weren't going my way, when I wasn't, things weren't turning out how I expected them to, alcohol was always my refuge, and that became the tougher and tougher things got. The more I drank, and the more it sort of compounded itself, so that my marriage started to fail. My wife and my children didn't trust me. I was drinking at work, and I'd been sprung a few times, and my employment situation was starting to become a bit dodgy, and things started to sort of really collapse, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like it's going in a good direction.
No, definitely not.
So, Lisa, you got into AA and got sober a bit. So what happened?
Eventually got sober. Yeah. When I first went to AA, I would hear people sharing about how they went to their first AA meeting and hadn't had a drink for you know, X amount of years afterwards. And I thought that was the norm for everyone that came into recovery. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case for me. It took me a lot of goes at AA. I would go to meetings, but I wouldn't connect with people. I'd come late or right on time, and I'd sit there, listen to it, and then leave. Wouldn't talk to people, so I couldn't stay sober. The thing was, I was trying to do it all on my own. I didn't reach out to people, and that was why, you know, why I couldn't stay sober. And things had to change. I had to change before, you know, I really got into any decent recovery.
Right. Mm. So, Lindsay, how did you get into AA? You've come into AA a few times. So what was your first?
It was under protest. I was sort of frog march, basically, to my first meeting. As I said, things weren't going well at home, and I had sought through drug and alcohol counsellors and psychologists and such like. I'd sought some assistance, but I never told the truth to any of these people. They were never able to do anything for me because I just wouldn't be honest. And my wife, sort of, it was pretty much a, you know, throwing the hands in the air and being unable to know what to do, dragged me to my first AA meeting, and that was in 1998, and we went to one meeting. And both of us were unprepared. We didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were horrified by the stories that we heard. The disasters that people's lives were. Yeah. We could never heard anybody speak that way before about their own lives. It's not the sort of thing that people normally talk about. And we got sort of backed up into a corner after the meeting, and the finger was pointed in the chest, and we were just out of there, saying, "I'm never going back there again. I don't need that.
I'm not that bad."
No, I'm not that bad. I'm not like those people. And she agreed with me because it was a very confronting experience. But however, another 5 years, and 5 years of drinking, and things gradually getting worse, and getting worse from, you know, like a physical and mental point of view with me. I was starting to get severe physical and mental symptoms, and more you know, more dramas at work and more fights at home, and my children weren't talking to me. I think that my wife must have rung the AA hotline or had spoken to members of Alcoholics Anonymous and got some strong advice on how to make this work better the second time.
Yeah.
And she waited until some disaster happened at home, and I can describe the disaster, but I won't, because it's quite distressing. But took me to another meeting, and this time accompanied me, and took me to not just one meeting, but to several. We went to, I think, probably five meetings together, long enough for me to actually start to listen to what some of these people were saying, and to relate to what I was hearing to my own life. The first time around, I was really looking for things that would exclude me from this fellowship. Yeah, I wanted to hear all of the things that didn't relate to me.
Yeah.
And this time I was able to stay long enough to actually hear some people who really made me feel very uncomfortable about my own behaviour. And for me to get up and share myself at a meeting, yeah, I couldn't get out of it, while my wife was in the room, and I had to talk about my alcoholism to her, which I'd never done before.
Yeah.
And that was a huge thing, you know.
Yeah.
And I stayed long enough to make some connections with some other people. I didn't come there to make friends, but I found myself relating very strongly to some people. And I started wanting to go to meetings. And the big thing for me was that I was actually learning about my own condition. I'd been an alcoholic for a long time, but I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I didn't want to know. I was in complete denial. And going to several meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to overcome that denial and to start really learning about what was wrong with me.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, I think we're up to a break, so I've got a CD queued up, and it's called Reach Out, I'll Be There. It's by Human Nature off their Motown record, so here it is.
Now if you feel that you can't go on,
Welcome back. That was a song called Reach Out, I'll Be There by Human Nature from their Motown record. Welcome back to Living Free. We're on 3CR, 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on your digital radio. As you may be aware, our radiothon was in June, and I can let you know that 3CR has currently raised $210,000. And thanks to your generosity, that means we can get on with presenting great radio for another year. We usually do a couple of plugs for events and fundraisers at this point of the show, and there's a couple today. I'll just read them out. First one is celebrating Cuba's revolution with great music and a documentary from Cuba. That's Sunday the 23rd of July, 2:30 till 5 p.m. And the venue is the Unitarian Church, 110 Gray Street, East Melbourne, 3002. Entry cost $15. The next one is Jam for Jobs and Justice, a fundraiser for the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. And that's at the Bally Union on Sunday the 30th of July, 2 till 5 p.m. Level 1, Trades Hall, corner of Lygon and Victoria Street, Carlton. You can book online at bellyunion.com.au. Tickets $10 or $15 at the door. Okay, so I'm in the studio today with Lisa and Leslie. They're members of AA, and they're talking about alcoholism and recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Lisa, we were talking about you getting into AA and then sort of not recovering immediately, but I understand you then went off to live your life for another few years before you came back.
Yeah, I got myself into rehab when I was 35. Up until that point, I'd worked in the advertising industry and the travel industry. I sort of gravitated towards these high stress, industries where it was very social and a lot of drinking. So that really helped my alcoholism. But when I was 35, I was working in travel. I had a fabulous job. I started having panic attacks, and I couldn't work out what was going on. I'd been pretty adventurous and travelled the world and, done a lot of things in my life, and suddenly I was finding it really hard to walk out the front door. My drinking was really bad at that stage. My life sort of, I'd start out, a new job or a new interest or a new course or a new relationship, and start out really motivated and healthy and not drinking, and I'd just pick up a drink and start spiraling downwards. I also suffered from depression, which went in conjunction with my drinking. So at the age of 35, I was having awful panic attacks, and I resigned my job in travel, and I got myself into rehab for a 6-week program, a very expensive 6-week program. And it was fantastic, because for the first time in my life, I'd heard other people who did what I did and thought the way I thought and felt like I felt. So I think, the shock of all that and the relief and the fun I was having in rehab and, for the first time in a while, eating properly and, being healthy and not drinking for an extended period, I didn't take in what I could have taken in. And I actually did drink after I got out of rehab, and I went on for the next, about 10 years, stopping and starting drinking, and it just got worse and worse. I went to AA. I got in 2001 again. I got sober for a few months and then picked up. And the same thing happened in 2003. Same thing happened in 2005. So, I'm trying to explain how, I was a slow learner. I wasn't one of those people who went to their first meeting, got it instantly and never drank again, which I found is not the norm. Most people struggle with recovery. It's, particularly, when we've been drinking for years and years, and that's our go-to solution for everything in life. you know, suddenly you take the booze away. What? How do I cope? How do I live? You know, what do I do?
What's the replacement? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have a replacement, and unfortunately, you know, I could not ask for help. I found it extremely difficult to ask for help. I found it really hard to open up and to be honest about what was going on, because, you know, I hadn't been honest with myself for a hell of a long time, if ever, really. Mm. And, you know, in my case, I think coming from an alcoholic home too, you know, it was, you know, my childhood was full of denial too. So I had to get over the whole stigma thing of having alcoholic parents, you know, trying to pretend that wasn't true. And then the shock of me being an alcoholic and my own denial. So, you know, it took a lot of work for me to really say, oh my God. But I was in 2008, you know, I was in another period of active alcoholism, you know, also in a major depression as well, which, you know, went hand in hand with my drinking. And I was lying in bed hungover one morning or one afternoon, and I was flicking through the radio and I heard this radio show out of the blue. Wow. And I recognised someone who was speaking on the show. And just, you know, if any of the listeners out there know what it's like with a hangover, and it's just awful. And this voice just cut through that fog, and I recognised the voice, and then I went, oh my God, AA. And it was like it all came back. It cut through that denial. And, you know, a couple of days later, I was back at an AA meeting, and I think I realised, or I was ready, or I heard the right story. I don't know. Just all the stars were aligned, and I just knew I have to do whatever it takes. I can't go out back there again because, you know, I don't know if I've got another recovery in me. You know, yeah. It gets harder as you get older. You don't bounce back like you do in your 20s.
Yeah.
And, so I did, I heard, thank God, the, you know, do 90 meetings in 90 days, which I did, and that was just so crucial to staying sober. And, I finally, for the first time, you know, opened up to people, you know, just said, look, I've just got to do whatever it takes. And I started talking to people, and I got phone numbers. And once you start going to a lot of meetings, you recognise faces, and, you know, just you make that connection, because, you know, coming from feeling so alone and, you know, most of the time think you're going crazy because of your behaviour, and, you know, people say, why do you do it? Why? You promised you were only going to have two drinks, and you can't explain it because we don't know. And, you know, no one really knows about alcoholism. I thought I knew all about it coming from an alcoholic
home.
Yeah,
being a drinker, yeah.
No, but coming, you know, my mum and dad's an alcoholic. But it's just such an insidious, and they say cunning, baffling, powerful. Mm. And, you know, it's so ingrained in the Australian culture. You know, it's the only legal drug apart from smoking, you know. And so, you know, it's legal, it's cheap, it's available. You know,
it's promoted, the
millions they spend on advertising. Yeah. I mean, you know, who has a chance? And when you're alcoholic and you don't know it,
yeah.
I mean, I hope one day in the future, you know, when babies get that test when they're born, you know, whatever they do, I don't have kids, they're able to say, oh, here, we have an alcoholic here, you know, and then eventually they'll give them a vaccine or something. But, you know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of treatment out there. But AA works. You know, you got to do something about it. You got to try.
You got to face up to it.
You got to face up to it. But, you know, once you do and accept that you have a problem, and it's a problem that can be managed, I mean, you look at people with, you know, well, this is a life-threatening illness, but there's a treatment. Yeah. And I'm living proof. You know, it's funny that it's amazing that 6 years today, it's 6 years ago today since I finished drinking, since I had my last drink. And that's,
wow, yeah, that's fantastic.
You know, my sobriety's lasted longer than my longest job. So, yeah, I'm really, really happy in my life today.
Yeah, yeah. It really helps to understand alcoholism as a disease and disease concept. And you know, from the family side, from Al-Anon family groups, we see it as a family disease. So it's not just the disease of alcoholism in the alcoholic. It's that comes into the family, and it sort of affects the whole family. So all the family members, like you were saying, everybody's denying, nobody's telling the truth. It's very hard being brought up in a situation like that as a child to sort of understand what's right and wrong and, you know, how you should act.
Well, you don't know because, for a start, you know, you get home from school and I remember I think I invited some kids over one day and, you know, my parents, you know, got home, started fighting and whatever, and I'm turning up the music louder and louder, and I never brought kids home again.
No.
You know, so I grew up, you know, keeping that whole part of my life secret. And, you know, we just don't know what it's like. Alcoholism is such an insidious disease. It's, it's a medical condition, but it affects you emotionally, you know, it affects your material life, it affects everybody around you.
Yep.
You know, it affects your job, but, you know, it goes through society, and there's just so much about it that people don't know.
They don't understand, I think, is the issue.
They don't understand because that information doesn't get out there. And I often think, you know, maybe if I'd known more about it, maybe if they teach, you know, in schools that, you know, it's not a disease of willpower, it's, you know, I can't will myself to be sober. And, you know, if I've had the experience where someone has tried to stop me in the middle of a drinking session and it's dangerous. It's really dangerous. My sponsor says to me, you know, you would have walked over broken glass to get to your next drink.
Mm.
And I say, yeah, I probably did quite often because I broke a lot of glasses in my drinking. Yeah.
Okay, Lindsay. So you were just talking earlier about just coming into AA after, I think, five years between your first your second visits. So so what did you learn coming into AA?
Previously the type of treatment that I'd sought was through drug and alcohol counsellors and through psychologists and through my doctor. All of them were very knowledgeable and very well-meaning. But what I discovered about Alcoholics Anonymous was that the people that I was relating with there actually had lived experience of this, and the way that they spoke about it was totally different. They were speaking from what had actually happened to them, and it just had so much more power for me. And the other thing was because they had the same illness as me, I couldn't lie. You know, I
couldn't fool them. Yeah.
And early in my sobriety, I started working with a new drug and alcohol counsellor who was a member of our fellowship, one who's very, very dear to many people in our fellowship.
Yeah.
And she was the first drug and alcohol counsellor that I couldn't lie to.
Yeah.
She would not, she would call me on every lie. And I was able to talk to her about, you know, things that were happening within my own family and my relationship with my wife and that sort of thing. And she'd say, you know, just shut up, Lindsay. Just keep your mouth shut. Let things happen by themselves. And there were things that I'd never heard before. And, I was just thinking that the way that meetings are run, the respect that people have for each other, the way that they allow people to speak without talking over the top of each other, these are things that I'd never experienced. You know, I was working in professional job with doctors and nurses and scientists and such like. Their meetings were chaos compared to our Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because they treated one another with respect and humility. And I really did start to enjoy and my self-respect those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and learning so much about my own condition from people who had it themselves was just so valuable to me.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, one thing I found with my father, that once I respected his right to be an alcoholic, then I could cope with him. But when I thought what he was doing it intentionally to harm the family, I couldn't do that. But once I realised that he had a disease, he had an illness, wasn't his fault, then once you take away that fault finding, then it's really easy to let someone else get on with their life. Yeah. And we had a really good relationship after that because I wasn't pressuring him to be something he couldn't be or to do things that he couldn't do. And that's really important, yeah. So I think, you know, at meetings, just allowing people, you know, the right to talk and to recover at their pace certainly helps people to, you know, be serious that it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're up to another song. This is another one by Human Nature, and it's Keep Me Carrying On. Keep Me Hanging On. Sorry. Oh, welcome back. And that was You Keep Me Hanging On by Human Nature from their Motown record. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR, on digital radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. I'm talking to Lindsay and Lisa today about alcoholism and how AA has helped them. So Lindsay, coming into AA, things change, but you've still got to cope with life. So how is that as a newly recovered alcoholic?
That was very challenging, Bill, because my belief was that the only thing that was wrong with my life was my drinking, and if I stopped drinking, everything would be wonderful. And initially it was wonderful to be able to understand that, yes, I wouldn't die if I stopped drinking. That was something that I was worried about. And I'm so habituated and to alcohol that if I stopped, my heart might stop. It was exhilarating to know that it was possible to be able to, you know, physically do this. But on the other hand, life went on, and the usual challenges that life presents were there. And now I didn't have alcohol to fall back on. I'd become habituated to using alcohol in every circumstance where the going got a bit tough or things weren't going my way. Now I had to find other ways of dealing with those circumstances, and that was where the main challenges were. And I didn't necessarily deal with those circumstances well. So things in my home life and my working life didn't necessarily improve fantastically. I was still feeling angry and restless and irritable and discontent, and I was having trouble coping with the with the normal aspects of life.
Yeah. So what sort of things did you think would improve once you got into AA?
Oh, well, I knew that all the basic things to do with drinking, hangovers for a start, that was something that I was really glad that I'd gotten rid of. And also my physical health was definitely deteriorating. I was finding physical symptoms of, liver enlargement and such like. Those things settled down quite well. My mental health was suffering badly, and gradually some of that, I was taking antidepressants and drinking at the same time, which they just do not work. Mm. Because I was suffering from clinical depression, the medication that I was taking started to work properly, and I started to feel better from that point of view. But my ability to relate to my family members and to my workmates was a bit more challenging, because I was more volatile and more difficult to get on with in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's still ism, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Without the alcohol, you're still the same person, and you've got to deal with those issues.
Yeah. What do they say, the drunken horse thief? You know, you take away the alcohol and you're still the horse thief.
Yeah. That's good.
And I was still pretty mad, still a very angry person, feel very resentful and full of fear. But Alcoholics Anonymous offers me a program of recovery that helps me to deal with those things. It was something that I didn't feel like as though I needed to do initially, so my recovery from alcoholism was considerably longer than it needed to be. And people continue to suffer as a result of that, especially in my own family.
Yeah.
But the 12-step program that Alcoholics Anonymous encourages us to embark on is a direct way of dealing with resentments, fears, and harms that we've done to other people. And it wasn't really until I made a good fist of doing those 12 steps that things started to really improve.
Yeah, that's great. Lisa, when you came to AA the last time, I'll say it the last
yeah,
time.
The last time.
Yeah. not to try and, cast any shadows, but you found that the people were a bit different than when you first came in, so it wasn't all old guys over 50.
No, thank goodness. I don't think I would have stayed around. When I came back again, I'd had a few goes, obviously. I got to a beginner's group, which was just what I needed, and there were quite a few women there, and I don't know, it was very welcoming. It was all geared towards newcomers to AA, which was what I needed, and, even though I'd been in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out, I hadn't learnt anything about what was wrong with me, and having the attitude of I knew it all anyway.
Yeah.
My ears weren't open, or I wasn't open to hearing much in prior times. And look, the stars aligned, the right people were there. I was, broken enough in my alcoholism to, be willing to do whatever it took. To take some direction, to finally listen to what other people were saying. I had to put my ego aside. I had to learn some humility, which was extremely hard. They say that you can be too smart for recovery, and and
there's none too dumb, but there's those too smart.
Yeah, a lot too smart. And I also, physically, I would get well really, really quick. Not realizing that the mental and emotional, healing took a bit longer. But I just it was, I think, the fellowship part of AA, I discovered that for the first time. And that made all the difference to me. The people were welcoming, they were friendly, and, you know, I could finally, you know, drop those walls, you know, around me that had been there for forever, really.
Yeah.
And again, you know, started to work with a sponsor and actually work the 12-step program instead of just, you know, reading it on the board and think that was what it meant when they said doing the steps. It's not just sitting
it's
in a meeting and reading it on the, you know, reading it on the banner. That's not doing. You have to meet with a sponsor, go through the big book, do some, for me it was homework about, you know, for step one, admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol. It was, you know, look at the ways that I'm powerless, look at what happened, how I was feeling, you know, the things that I'd said I was going to do and didn't, or, you know, just the recurring, you know, I'm just going out for a few drinks and, you know, you don't see me that night, or the things that I missed because I was too drunk or too hungover. Just that obsession with alcohol coloured every aspect of my life and my being.
Mm. And do you, what do you attribute relapses to?
For me, as I had quite a few relapses, for me it was complacency. That was my last relapse, was from complacency, I would say. I got cocky. I thought, oh, I'm okay now because I've got some sobriety up. I've done the steps. Yeah. I feel better. My life is better. I can relax a bit. And you can't, you know, you can't relax with this disease because it's always there. It's not curable. It's manageable. But I think the biggest thing for me was I finally said, I need help. I had such a difficult time asking for help. I think, you know, the day that they were teaching how to ask for help in school, I missed that class and never got the follow-up notes. And and coming from an alcoholic home too, you don't ask for help. You can't. And that was the first time I actually asked a member of AA for help. And it was actually just with a car problem. I cried because it was so hard. It was so difficult. But yeah, no, I finally got a great sponsor, asked for her help at 3 a.m, and she did, and I'm so relieved and free and happy today.
Yeah, that sounds good. So, Lindsay, what's it like now that you've been recovered for a few years? How's your life different?
Oh, my life is totally different to what it was when I first got sober. That was nearly 15 years ago, and I was still employed in my original job, and I look back and think, I don't know how they possibly kept me on.
Yeah.
My behaviour must have been terrible. I was married. My three children were living with us. And I had a house and a mortgage. And many of these things were, I look back now and I think these were the things that I wanted to get sober to keep. And as the way things have gone, you know, 15 years, I've got no... older, I've retired now. I don't have that job. I left that job. I took early retirement from that job because of a death in my family that really flattened me. My marriage has been long, well and truly over. We've been separated, divorced for 8 years. And I don't know, sort of say that my marriage didn't survive my recovery. I think that she realised that it wasn't just the drinking that she didn't like about it. And so now she has another partner, and I have a partner who happens to also be in fellowship, and it's we're sort of, each of us have better suited partners to us than originally. But I've been retired for 5 years. During my early recovery, I started doing guitar making as a hobby, and also to sort of develop some new skills. I was sort of painted myself into a corner with my professional career and wanted to do something totally different. And the time that Lisa was talking about when she went to Bali with her girlfriends, I thought that I was going too, and found out it was a girls' weekend. So I thought, bugger it, I'm going to Hawaii and I'm going to learn how to build ukuleles. And I did a ukulele building course, and I now find great enjoyment in building ever increasingly better ukuleles, and I've actually recently completed one specifically for another fellowship member who's a professional player and teacher, and that's
fantastic.
The satisfaction in that is just wonderful. And, you know, I live a quiet and simple life these days. I don't spend a lot of dough. I've got a limited amount of money. I don't have an income anymore apart from my superannuation and pension. And Alcoholics Anonymous continues to play a large part in my life because I've got to a stage where previously I had nothing to give. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing left and all I could do was take.
Yep.
After 15 years or so of recovery, I now have something to offer others who are new in recovery, and that's one of my greatest satisfactions. And my home group, of which I am currently the secretary, is Preston Beginners Discussion Group on right. Monday night at 7:30. 220 High Street, Preston, just a bit of a plug. And that we welcome people to their first ever meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we cater specifically for them. It's a discussion group meeting, so they get the opportunity to ask questions. And questions like, you know, how do I know that I'm an alcoholic? And what do I tell other people about my drinking? And you know, just simple questions like this that they may not be able to find the answers to at some of the different structured meetings. And it's a great satisfaction to be able to give people at least an introduction, at least a start to Alcoholics Anonymous with the right information. They don't always come back.
No.
You know, some people come to their first meeting, they see the word God on the wall and they say, this is a religious cult, I'm out of here.
Yep.
Which was what happened to me when I was 21, and then when I was 35, I came back. But, you know, the damage done in those intervening years.
Yep.
But, yeah, Lindsay was talking about the Preston Beginners meeting on Monday nights at 7:30. That meeting saved my life, and that's where I really got my foundations in recovery. There's great meetings all around Australia, the world, different types of meetings, women's meetings, men's meetings,
and there's
LGBTIQ meetings.
And there's conventions.
And conventions.
As well. We love conventions.
Yeah, the fellowship is very strong, isn't it? That's one thing that I found too, that my relationship with my family wasn't particularly good. And what I found in Al-Anon was that I had a lot of people who were closer than my actual family.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, that relationship that you build with people who are in a similar situation to you is fantastic.
It's priceless. Yeah. It's priceless. The thing is about addiction, any addiction, it's such a lonely, lonely disease.
Yep.
And you get into, you know, recovery, AA, Al-Anon, NA, you find people just like you. They've been through the same things you have. They've thought the same way you have. They feel the same way you do, and you just have this instant connection. You have something in common, and, you know, together we can do this thing. You know, it's too hard alone. Don't try and do it on your own. Don't make the mistakes I did.
Don't try this at home.
Reach out, please.
Yeah. And I understand, Lisa, you're doing a bit of study next year to get more involved.
Yeah, well, I found, you know, such joy in my recovery, and also I help other women. I sponsor other women through the 12 steps. I've presented at a couple of 12-step workshops, and I'm on a rehab and detox roster, and I find great joy in that. So next year I'm going back to school to study drug and alcohol addiction. So there you go, full circle.
Yeah.
Giving back.
That's wonderful.
It sounds good. Mm-hmm. And so you also do that too, Lindsay. You're involved with rehabs and treatment centres. Yeah.
Yes. That's right. Doing visits I'm going to one tonight at Leslie Ann Curran Place in Heidelberg, and so I'm on a regular visiting roster for that.
Okay.
And that's just to introduce the possibility that there may be a solution to people who are in detox and not usually at the best part of their lives.
No.
And if they can hear from other people who have been where they are,
yep,
and see that there's an answer, it can give them hope.
Yeah. No, I think that's very important, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I think we're just about finished for the day. So if anybody is interested in contacting AA, if you think AA could help you, then you can phone them on 1300 222 222, or go online at aa.org.au. That's really all we've got. Oh, sorry, Lindsay.
Can I just suggest another website as well? It's aatimes.org.au, which gives information on meetings and events.
Okay, thank you very much. That's really all we've got time for today. So thanks for listening to Living Free. I'd like to thank our guests, Lindsay and Lisa.
Thanks, Bill.
It's a pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your AA recovery experience with us. So we'll see you all next week when we'll be talking with some guests from Narcotics Anonymous who will share their experience with drug addiction and how NA has helped them. Stay tuned now for Black Noise Radio, hosted by Kerry Lee and featuring black news and views, current affairs, music, sport, culture and the arts, all from an Aboriginal woman's perspective. To take us out, we've got a song called Man Overboard by Do Re Mi.
I try not to stand too close to myself. I try not to listen to the things I say. They say there's no such thing as self-abuse, but you wonder how I can be trusted if I'm finely tuned or well-adjusted. We'll be right back.
Smith Street Dreaming has become one of the area's most anticipated street festivals, featuring Pigeon Jarrah Man, Frank Yama, soul diva Emma Donovan, hip-hoppers Young Warriors, Indigenous hip-hop projects Wurundjeri Dance Group, Jindy Warraback, MC Shelley Ware from the Marngook Footy Show, and much more. Smith Street Dreaming, on the corner of Smith and Stanley Streets, Collingwood, Saturday the 22nd of July, 1 till 5pm. Smith Street Dreaming. One street, many mobs, one community. This is an alcohol and drug-free event. A 3CR supporter.
Oh, the very deadly sounds of Frank Yama there, of course. He'll be performing at Smith Street Dreaming, happening this Saturday, as you just heard the beautiful Viv talk about there on the radio in that promo. Thanks, Sister Viv. Good to be back on the radio. Good afternoon. Black Betty here with you on what is a damn cold Thursday afternoon, ain't it? So thanks to the crew here at 3CR for the love upon entry to the building. I need a little bit of love today, so it was good to walk in and see all that. Thanks, Leanne, as well. Big shout out to Leanne for getting in here and doing her business for me. Thank you so much, team. 3 minutes now past 2 o'clock this afternoon. Black Noise Radio coming to you. We were going to have a chat with someone from the Chooky Dancers today and hear what they'll be doing in Melbourne, but still tracking that interview down, so bear with me for that one. But a music special coming your way today. In fact, I've got a few events to let you know that are happening between now and Sunday, and in fact, it's going to be a pretty jam-packed weekend for blackfellas in Melbourne. So stay tuned. Lots of plenty of deadly music coming your way. Is what I'm trying to say this afternoon on the radio right here on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Good afternoon. I think my dad might be listening. I did send my old man, my main man, that's right, my main man, Daddy Martin, the web link so he can listen, because he lives in regional Australia, you could say, and quite a fair way away from Melbourne. So hopefully, Dad, you've worked out the web link on your computer, and hopefully you're listening to me now, and then I'll play a song for you. How's that? Just in case you're listening this afternoon, right here on 3CR, Black Noise Radio. Black Betty here with you this Savo, and plenty of deadly black tunes coming your way this afternoon. In fact, we're going to feature music that is coming from artists who will be performing between now and Sunday. That's right, over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday in particular. There's a couple of very deadly gigs.